This interview with Cynthia Enloe was recorded in October 15, 2002, and broadcast on Doug Henwood's Behind the News show on WBAI New York on October 17. Cynthia Enloe.
Welcome to WBAI. Cynthia Enloe, you've written about the subtlety of militarization of a culture, of a society, but now we're in the midst of a very overt 50-year war, the Vice President tells us. We're constantly reminded that we're at war and everything is different. How does this affect the kind of analysis that you do?
Well, it's a funny thing. I don't actually think it is so different. I think it's ratcheted up, and maybe it is more visible to a lot of us. But I think in American society, for instance, one of the things that has long been militarized is ordinary Americans, your and mine, notion of the presidency. And so the long-term building up of this notion, and I don't, not enough of a historian to know exactly when this started, but the notion that the presidency's essence is its role as commander-in-chief, that really militarizes this, what is essentially a civilian role. So George W. Bush has been able to play on something that has been happening for a while now. So some of what's going on now is not brand new, and I think it would be a mistake to think, oh, this has all just been since September 2001. I think that a lot of the things that the Bush administration has been able to build on has its roots in things that have been developing in American culture for quite some time now. And if we think that it's just a matter of this administration with its particular war-making obsession, I think we would get it wrong. I think we'd make a mistake, and it would be quite a serious mistake.
Well, let's talk a bit about some of those things that have been building. What kinds of phenomena and symptoms are you talking about when you're talking about the militarization of a culture?
Well, let's talk about how people think about Congress and how members of Congress think about themselves. Insofar as any of us as ordinary voters think about Congress and judge Congress as to in terms of whether an individual congressperson, member of the House or Senate, should be taken seriously insofar as they are capable of thinking about war, and that's the main criterion that any of us use to judge whether this is a really serious elected official, then it's not only the Congress has been militarized, I think we as ordinary citizens, voters, judges of Congress, we've also been militarized. Insofar as within the congressional culture, the House culture and the Senate culture, and they're not exactly the same, but insofar as anyone acting within that congressional culture judges themselves and judge each other in terms of whether their actions on war are the most significant actions they can be taken, as versus judging each other in terms of child care positions or judging each other in terms of health care positions. Insofar as they judge each other, and there are, of course, all kinds of hierarchies of prestige within Congress, amongst Congress people, in terms of their positions on war, their positions on national security, their positions on military doctrine, then, in fact, they have militarized themselves. You put those two things together, that is, we as individual voters and they as members of a particular subculture of Congress, and you really have a deeply militarized double culture of democratic or so-called democratic representation. That's very worrisome to me, and it certainly marginalizes women as voters, and it marginalizes women as members of the House and the Senate.
How does this happen? Is this the result of the U.S. imperial role in the world? Is it something that's common through a lot of cultures? Is there something specifically American about this?
Well, I think it's specific. Here's what I think. I think about this a lot, and your listeners probably have a lot more answers than I do. But my sense is that here's what's particularly American about it, I think, and that is this deference to the presidency, or at least to certain holders of the presidency. There wasn't much deference to Bill Clinton because he could be written off as not quite appropriately manly. George Bush, George W. Bush, who's had no more military service than, really, than Bill Clinton, somehow has managed to get beyond that. But the militarization or the deference to the presidency, I think, is peculiarly American. If you ask a Canadian, and I have a lot of Canadian friends, if you talk to Canadians, they would say, for instance, that Chrétien, the current Prime Minister of Canada, would never be able to pull off this kind of militarizing campaign. Prime ministers can't do it. Tony Blair's trying to, but then he's called presidential, and that's not a compliment in Britain. So I think that's one of the things that's peculiarly American. What is not peculiar and what is shared across a lot of cultures is the idea that those people in public life or in private life around the dinner table or at the pub who can most claim to be authoritative about military affairs are those who are most serious about public life in general. That is shared across cultures, which is one of the reasons that feminists have so much to share when they get together and talk about militarization. So you find Congolese feminists and Kenyan feminists and Filipino feminists and American feminists have a lot to share when they get around a table together.
For part of the recent history, or at least the run-up to this mobilization on Iraq, the military seemed less enthusiastic about going to war than some of the people in the civilian branch of government. Do you have any thoughts on why that might be?
Well, it's odd, isn't it? I think, Doug, that men and women in uniform are not necessarily the most deeply militarized of all the people in any society. It certainly is true that once one has decided to get one's sense of professional pride, to get one's sense of career reward from service in a uniformed military, insurgent or state, by the way, one is on the slippery slope to personal militarization. But it's not true that a person who doesn't wear khaki or have, as they say, scrambled eggs on your shoulder is immune to militarization. I don't think it's necessarily true that people in uniform are the most militarized people in any society. You can be deeply militarized, profoundly militarized, and dress in civvies. And that's true, I think, today. And in fact, one of the things that I've been most struck by is that a number of the Democratic skeptics in Congress were so delighted that former chiefs of staff, former senior military officers, were the ones who gave them the kind of words of caution about the invasion of Iraq. But that, of course, is militarizing the Democratic opposition, because the capital D Democratic opposition, because they, it's as if they depended on hearing the cautionary words from professional military men in order to justify their own caution, rather than thinking that their own thoughtful caution as elected civilian officials would be sufficient. No, no, they had to quote back gratefully, and it's the gratitude that's militarized, the words of professional military officers in order to feel secure in the public eye. That was very worrisome to me.
You, in writing on Virginia Woolf's essay, Three Guineas, you cite hierarchy, rivalry, and the privileging of masculinity as the holy trinity of militarism. Could you expand a bit on that?
Well, I came to Virginia Woolf kind of late, or at least later than a lot of friends of mine. And I've got, God, I don't know, I'm looking here at my shelves. I'm looking literally right at, I think I've got three dog-eared copies. And every time I read Three Guineas, which is a spiraling set of three essays into one, I find new things. And one of the things that Virginia Woolf, who was writing in 1938, she was writing on the verge of the opening of the European War, which the U.S. government only went into much later, and she was trying to figure out who really amongst her friends, many of whom were peace activists, male peace activists, who of them were really truly distanced from the lures of militarism. And she began to really, and I think she outraged her good friends, she began to really look deeply and think, if one is seduced by ideas of hierarchy, ideas of competitiveness, ideas of a certain kind or certain kinds of masculinity, some of which don't look much like Mussolini, one is vulnerable to, at least, and maybe even complicit in, the most overt, blatant kinds of militarism. So I find her really radical. I mean, she makes one quite uncomfortable because she says it's not enough to be a peace activist. It's not enough to be anti-fascist. It's not enough to be against a certain proposed invasion to be truly anti-militarist. One has to go much deeper in thinking about one's own gender values and one's own cultural assumptions.
Sounds a bit like what Foucault called the fascism in our heads.
Yes, right, but Virginia Woolf thought it first. Don't give Foucault too much credit.
That's the way he thinks it was happening, isn't it?
Yeah.
But these things also sound a lot like the kinds of personality types that are fostered by capitalism, competition, hierarchy. It's certainly opening up to women, but certainly historically has been a very masculine sphere. What's specifically military about this?
I think, well, two things. I think Woolf would have said, well, first of all, Woolf warned women about thinking that joining the competitive, hierarchical, masculinized club was really liberation. And she had a lot of caveats there for women in today as well as in her own time. But I think what is added to that is the belief in the naturalness of enemies and the belief in the organized use of violence to solve differences. So you add, and some capitalists, a lot of capitalists actually, are militarized, and some are simply exploitative in the way they carry on capitalism. But I think you're right. I think it's really important that we not just sort of slop around here and think that everything is the same, because then you lose a sense of why you're critical of, or at least suspicious of, what you are. I think capitalism and militarism are two sets of multiple-parted beliefs, and what distinguishes, I'm not talking about one being better than the other, but what distinguishes a capitalist from a militarist is that a militarist takes competitiveness, a belief in hierarchy, and adds to it a need to see enemies and a faith in organized violence as the resolver of problems.
A lot of capitalists would do business with anyone.
Well, absolutely. But I was interested in the New York Times today. This is October 14th, Columbus Day. Today's New York Times had a full-page ad, which, of course, costs a lot of money, put in by a group of business people, a lot of progressive investment people, Ben and Jerry's types, a number of small business people, but they all identify themselves as business people, what we would call capitalists, saying why the Bush administration's plans for, and the Congress's rolling over and giving the blank check to, war on Iraq is not to be supported. So that was quite interesting to me. I mean, there was no executive from Boeing, right? There was no executives from Lockheed. There were no executives from Raytheon in the fine print. There must have been 150, 200 names there of business people, all with their businesses identified. So there were none of the big contractors there. But it was interesting. They all identified themselves as business people, and as business people, they said that this kind of warmongering, in fact, was not good for business.
Feminists in recent years have been, or at least some, have done some agitation on getting women full recognition, full equality in the military. Similarly, a lot of gay and lesbian activists have fought to get gays and lesbians fully accepted in the military. this is, I imagine, something that you have deeply ambivalent feelings about. Could you sort through some of them?
Yeah, please? Ambivalence is right there on the mark, I think, Doug. I do have mixed feelings, and I'm going to leave them as mixed, because on the one hand, when you have a society, and this is the American society, not the Dutch society, not the Japanese society, not the Costa Rican society, this is the American, and I'm saying those other countries very deliberately, this is the American society in which the military institutions are so culturally, economically, and politically powerful that I don't think anybody with feminist goals can allow them to get away with sexism or with homophobia. They're so powerful that if you let the Defense Department, I mean the civilians and the uniform people, or you let the ROTC in your state university, or you let the junior ROTC in your local high school, if you let any one of them or all of them get away with homophobia as a policy, which is what it now is, with sexism, which is now not a policy but in fact is a practice, if you let those institutions get away with it in American society in 2002, you are making it very difficult to roll back sexism in the society as a whole, because those military institutions have been allowed by all of us to get so economically, culturally, and politically powerful in our society. So I think that sexism and homophobia has to be challenged, and challenged coherently in American society today, rather than saying, I know that if I take on the military, I'm going to become complicit in the military. I'm just going to leave it alone, and I'm going to work on some other issue where I don't even have to engage with a military contractor or the junior ROTC at the downtown high school. Having said that, though, see, this is really, it's tough, and I don't mean that I've got it all figured out. What I now know from years of trying to struggle with this, and a lot of my friends and people in audiences where I speak, making me struggle with it. On the other hand, I think it is a mistake, and I know a lot of hardworking equal opportunity campaigners will disagree with me on this, but I do think it's a mistake to imagine that winning equality inside a military institution is the path towards first-class citizenship. Because what that does is it militarizes the notion of first-class citizenship. And that is very risky. So I'm kind of now uncomfortably, but at this point, necessarily in my own head anyway, straddling a line or living with the ambivalence of trying to expose, with other people's help, where sexism and homophobia exists inside of all the military institutions, and yet not prioritizing women or gays and lesbians in the military as a measure of first-class citizenship in any society. Tricky, yeah?
Very. Another tricky thing is, you've been speaking of feminism as sort of implicitly critical of military values, and masculinist temperament or values as being sort of inseparable from the militarization of society. These don't neatly map onto biological men and women, though. So
how do we
sort all that out?
What we're talking about is ideas, we're talking about institutions, we're talking about practices, we're talking about assumptions, anxieties. We're not talking about biology. That is, that feminists from, well, certainly since the late 19th century, have been very clear, I think, and this is feminists in a lot of different societies, have been very clear that what they're opposed to is ideas about manliness, which is different than being born biologically a male. Ideas about manliness that then privilege people who can claim that manliness. And ideas about femininity that compel women regardless of their capabilities or their inclinations, to play certain kinds of deferential, privatized roles. That's really what feminism is all about. And I know that in the areas of anti-militarism, there is, and I certainly understand it, there's some days of the week that I think it makes sense. There are times when one does think that men are wired to be militaristic, but in fact, I don't believe that. I think that's in the level of cartoon, and that's in the level of you know, outrage when you just get so frustrated with why guys can't see it, you know, in quotes, that is, guys can't see it. But I know none of the many different feminists that I'm in correspondence with or work with in lots of different cultures, none of them really do subscribe to the idea that women are biologically peacemakers. What they will say is, if women in any society, as in many societies, most societies, are given responsibility for childcare and for child nurturing, it is not surprising that they are the first ones to take to the street in anti-conscription marches. But that's very different than saying it's part of the hormonal makeup. It's about thinking. It's about judging. It's about making assessments of how society works that leads women to be so prominent in peacemaking.
And habits of mind derived from occupying social roles.
That's right. Which then, of course, is quite confusing for some people, because if it's true that the very marginalized, underpaid or unpaid roles that women have been compelled to play in society, which are oftentimes the most privatized, the ones most responsible for child care and for the caring of elders, are in fact the roles that have taught women to disassociate themselves, not all women, by the way, from war making and from militarism, then should not those roles be cherished rather than disparaged? And I think what you find is a lot of feminists will say, we're not for women not being involved in childcare. We're for women's roles as child carers and as nurturers of families and nurturers of elders. We're for that being validated, for being treated as if it's the heart of what makes economies effective, what makes nations hold together, what makes for citizenship. That a middle-aged woman who takes care of elder parents should be seen as important as a New York firefighter.
I always have this bad habit of leaving to the last couple of minutes of an interview the question, how do we get out of this? But how do we get out of this militarization of society?
Well, I think one of the things is, Doug, is that we all together have to face up to how complicit a lot of us are in it. And that's really hard. I mean, it really is easier to talk about Rumsfeld or to talk about, unfortunately, Colin Powell's complicity or to talk about the passivity of John Kerry and Hillary Clinton and even Chuck Schumer, alas, alack, in the recent congressional votes. Nancy Pelosi, by the way, is one of my current heroes. But, in fact, I think that militarization only will be rolled back if we all start itemizing in a really intimate way how complicit we all can be in it. Putting it under the light, showing it for what it is, makes it much harder for anyone to militarize us in the name of something else.
How do we begin this process?
Well, first of all, I think we stop giving deference to presidents because in the Constitution they have amongst their many roles commander-in-chief. I mean, that really is a first thing. I think Americans absolutely have to rethink what presidents are and bring them back down to size. A second thing, I think we have to take feminists really seriously and bring notions of masculinity right back up to center stage, not in an essentialist way, but as a way of trying to explain why so many of us and so many people in public life seem so afraid to take on presidents when they don the windbreaker of commander-in-chief. And that will go a long way. It's a different kind of national dialogue, I think, but it takes surprising guts to do that.
All right. Well, thank you for your part in doing that, and thanks for joining us.
Okay, sure. It's nice to be with you.